You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Well, butter pies all round tonight at the Vuelta a España. They'll be dancing in the tapas bars of Preston bus station tonight as well, as one of our listeners said on our Facebook page. Hugh Carthy wins at the Angleroo, the mythical Angleroo, the eerie Angleroo today. My name's Richard Moore and I'm with Lizzie Banks.
Good evening, Daniel.
Oh, very good. Very good. And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Hello, thank you, Lionel.
Have you been reading my tale of the tapas? Because my opening line is butter pies all round. But there we are. I won't be able to say that now. I have to say something different.
Say it again. I mean, you can't have too many butter pies, can you?
No.
You of all people. Are we? Did we enjoy today's stage, Lizzie? Did it? You were a bit disappointed last night. You happy tonight?
Yeah. No. I thought it was a sensational stage, and. You know, I'm a little bit biased with a Brit winning the stage. And obviously I was screaming at the TV, yelling for him to, after his first attack, to, and then kind of he got reabsorbed by the bunch to not get dropped and hang on. And then when he made his second attack, it was the time, the gaps that he put into that group. It was really sensational. So, yeah, it was a great day.
I mean, Hugh Carthy really proved the doubters wrong, didn't he? The detractors, the critics. In the media, some of the voices in the media who've written him off.
Just lastly on Carthy, Rich, I don't know what you think, but I mean, he does seem to ride a bigger gear than, he's not a twiddler, is he, like Roglic? And I do think that might be problematic on the Angleroo, where, you know, it really is about, there's an element of souplesse and force in all climbing, isn't there? It's a combination. You have to be able to do a bit of both. That might be tricky when it's absolutely super steep.
The great thing about this is that when he wins on the Angleroo, we can play this bit. He really shoved it in their face today, didn't he, Lionel?
He did, Richard. Yes, thank you. Although, I mean, this is pretty galling coming from you, because you're the man who said that the idea of Geraint Thomas winning the Tour was fanciful.
Well, I stand by that.
Within an hour of him pulling on the yellow jersey at Alpe d'Huez, having won the stage.
It was actually the previous night I said that, before Alpe d'Huez.
Whenever it was. But even so... You know, Hugh Carthy prefers to ride in a bigger gear than some of the other riders in that he's in company with. I mean, when you contrast him with Primoz Roglic, it's noticeable, and I'd noticed it. That's all I said. I mean, obviously, he was in exactly the right gears at the right time for him on the Angleroo today.
I don't think anyone had much of a choice about riding in a big gear on the Angleroo today. And when I was watching him, actually, I think the way that he swings his bike when he's attacking from one side to the other, that almost emphasises the cadence. And on a climb like that, you know, they're going to be going at 40 RPM some of the time. So, you know, everybody is in a really, really big gear. But yeah, he obviously likes to spin a big gear, but often for climbers, and often when you're actually in really good form, you know, the better your form, sometimes the bigger gear you ride. But it worked for him today.
I mean, he is an old school climber, isn't he? He does look like a sort of a 1980s climber.
You can imagine him with no socks on, can't you?
Yeah, only putting handlebar tape on the drops, that kind of thing that they used to do in the old days.
Some world-class gurning as well. But have you got the headlines, please, Lionel, if we haven't spoiled them all already?
It was all about the Angleroo today, wasn't it? Stage 12 of the Vuelta. And we did hope last night that the steep gradient would open up the gaps, and indeed it did. And Preston's Hugh Carthy of EF Pro Cycling has joined José María Jiménez, Gilberto Simoni, Roberto Heras, Alberto Contador twice, Wout Poels and Kenny Elissonde as a Vuelta stage winner on the Angleroo. I mean, it's a modern classic, but he said in his press conference afterwards it's a mythical climb, and it is a mythical climb. It has earned that status in a relatively short period of time, first used in 1999, of course. The other big headline is that the red jersey goes back to Richard Carapaz. Before that, there had been a big break of 23 riders, but it was never allowed much time, mainly because I think the stage was only 109 kilometres and nobody wanted to let anything get too far out of hand. Things started to get really interesting on the penultimate climb, the Alto de Cardal. With around 25 kilometres to go, Luis Leon Sanchez, the Spanish champion, riding for Astana, of course, and Matea Cataño of De Koenig Quickstep. They went clear of the rest of the break. Guillaume Martin went across too. And for a while, that looked like a pretty good trio up the road. It wasn't to be for them, of course. Meanwhile, back down the hill on that same climb, there was some real excitement when Chris Froome and Richard Carapaz attacked in tandem. Jumbo-Visma did get that situation under control pretty quickly, but Froome looking good on the climb today, and we'll probably talk about that later in the episode. Anyway, the break was caught, and then on the Angliru, it was exactly what we had been hoping for, a shootout for the stage win between the GC riders, plus Alexander Vlasov of Astana, who has now become almost a GC rider in this race because he's jumped up the standings. Jumbo-Visma were there in numbers again. Riders were getting dropped according to their places on GC. Marc Soler went backwards, then Grosschartner and Valverde were dropped as well. And, well, we've been talking about Sepp Kuss and how strong he's looked. He did look very strong again today. It almost looked easy for him at times.
Strong or just smooth?
Both,
yeah.
Totally. Another Jumbo-Visma rider, a young Dane riding his first Grand Tour, Jonas Vingegaard. He did a lot of damage for Jumbo-Visma, and it was his effort on the front that was whittling down that group to really just the main GC riders. So the real action was kicked off when Enric Mas of Movistar attacked with 3.6 kilometres to go. That was when Kuss took over the chase for Jumbo-Visma, and suddenly we were down to this large handful of GC riders. And Hugh Carthy made his move to go across to Mas, a big effort that I thought at the time he might pay for, but well, when it comes to Hugh Carthy, I clearly don't know what I'm talking about, because he hung in there and recovered when he was eventually caught, and of course went again. Carapaz actually kicked things off a bit. There was no response from Primoz Roglic, and Roglic was left to cling to the wheel of Sepp Kuss, who kept doing that little half turn over his shoulder just to check that his team leader was all right. But man of the day, Hugh Carthy, he went again with 1,300 metres to go, a very impressive stage win. And as I say, anyone who doubted that the climb would suit him, clearly an idiot. Vlasov, Mas and Carapaz came in next. They were 16 seconds down. Then came Roglic, Kuss and Dan Martin. They were another 10 seconds back, and then it was a big gap, 109 to Wout Poels, who has jumped up to sixth place overall. Vlasov, as I said, has also moved up, but the real story is at the top of the standings, Carapaz now leads Roglic by 10 seconds going into Tuesday's time trial.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWocker. If you run a business, find out more at iWocker.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
iWocker is our title sponsor and has been since the spring. Of course, they've seen us through all of the Grand Tours this year, and they're backing us through the Grandest Tour as well. And well, they've coped with the first lockdown and now have a second lockdown coming, which has changed all of our working practices, really. We've been hearing from iWocker members of staff a little bit about their charity bike ride from London to Brighton, and one of the riders on that ride was James Turner, and he runs the IT operation at iWocker. And once lockdown happened and more people were working at home, well, that presented lots of challenges for all sorts of businesses, including iWocker. So I wanted to know how he had coped with so many of iWocker's staff members suddenly having a home office, and especially with a company like iWocker, which is lending money and needs to be extremely secure. How did they deal with that?
With what iWocker does, i.e. lending money to small businesses, security is always great importance to us. I would say that as an IT manager, I had a great sort of helping hand in the fact that iWocker is not a big sort of incumbent bank style company. We've been very innovative in the way we set out our stall technically, and we have a lot of modern methodologies, meaning that really the network, even within our offices, is treated just as an internet connection, and we really concentrate on the connectivity and authorization and identity assuredness of our applications. If we already allowed people to work from the coffee shop securely, actually increasing that out in scope to everyone working from their house securely was not a big jump for us.
If you run a small business, you may be interested in what iWOCA can do for you. Go to iwoca.co.uk, that's iwoca.co.uk, to find out more about the business.
Well, as you said, Lionel, all about the Angleroo today. Alberto Contador, who won up there the last time in 2017, was on Eurosport today saying that it was the hardest climb in cycling, harder than the Zonkalan. There's just no respite, and incredibly steep in places, as we saw. And really, you know, one of the features, we've got that fantastic picture by Simon Gill, of course, of Contador in 2017. One of the things that makes that picture great is the fans around him cheering him on and really sort of involved in the action. And the thing about today was there were no fans, and it was very eerie looking. And I don't know, but I had a much clearer sense watching it of the toughness of the climb, because there was nothing to detract or distract from the riders just making an effort to kind of winch their way up, really. It was like watching climbers on El Capitan in Yosemite or something, just very slowly inching their way up the climb. It was a really remarkable spectacle, an unusual spectacle, but a remarkable one. Enric Mas deserves great credit today. We joked that he'd ridden in an a la Zibaldia way at the Tour de France, but cannot be accused of that today. He really lit the fire, didn't he, today? Which it drew out Carthy and Richard Carapaz as well, who'd looked to be, if not struggling, then not on the best of days. He was at the back of the group of GC riders, but he kind of came forward, and it was a case of some riders going forward and then back and then forward again. And Roglic did struggle a bit, but in the end, I think he's the leader in the clubhouse. You know, he's 10 seconds down on Carapaz with the time trial on Tuesday, very much still in the driving seat. And as you said as well, he owes Sepp Kuss a favour. Sepp Kuss, I don't think he's opened his mouth yet this Vuelta. Only to eat does he open his mouth. But he just looks so comfortable and relaxed. An unusual spectacle for the lack of fans, but as you said, Lizzie, a thoroughly enjoyable one.
Both Vlasov and Enric Mas's rides were both sensational. And I think the only reason why they're not going to get picked up as being sensational by the wider public is because Hugh Carthy's ride was just exceptionally sensational, and then overshadowed actually their incredible rides as well. And I was just talking to Lionel before, and I was wondering what happened to Vlasov on stage one, because I think he was down in 40th or 41st down on stage one. And then since then, he's just been chipping and chipping away, and he's really had such good rides all week. And now he's up in 9th on GC. And so to come from 41st, and I think he lost four or five minutes on the first stage, to come back into the top 10 is really quite an amazing ride. And, you know, he's only 24. It's another story of these young guns coming through in this unusual year.
Yes, you're right, Lizzie. Hugh Carthy's ride was exceptional, wasn't it? And, so often we see riders either attack, blow up, and then that's them done for the day, or we see everyone sit and wait, fearful of attacking, blowing up, and being done for the day. Whereas today, Hugh Carthy went across to Mass. That didn't work out. He was then back in the group, and then he had to kind of gather his thoughts and gather his breath a bit, and then when he went again, he made it stick. I mean, you know, that really can't underestimate the difficulty of doing that on a climb as difficult as the Angleroo.
On a climb like that, it is so, so steep. If you go into the red just the tiniest bit, then you're not going to have the chance to recover, because there isn't a single moment until the final downhill 500 metres that you can actually recover. And I think that kind of yo-yoing and going back and forth was the story of the day of all the big riders in the end, really, because we saw going up the climb, Carapaz was, once he'd, you know, he was alone for the whole of that final climb, and he was started behind Roglic, and then he slipped back, and one rider, and then another rider, and another rider, and then there was a point where one of the riders in front of him dropped out, and then he actually had to close that gap. And that is the real risk of being at the back, and that is why you want to be further forward, because actually, if there's 9 riders in a row and you're going up a super steep climb, the time it takes from the first rider going past a certain point to the 9th rider might actually be 3 or 4 seconds because it's so steep and you're going so slowly. And so, you know, he really looked like he was on the ropes, and then he moved up a bit and then he attacked and then he came back and then he attacked again. And the same with Dan Martin, you know, he really looked like he was going to get dropped and be fully dropped. Then he clawed his way back. Then he went off the front. Then he came back into the group and finally ended up in the third group on the road of Roglic. So yeah, it's such a hard climb. I mean, I've never ridden it, but I can only just imagine from seeing the pictures on the TV. And you've really just got to ride your own race in some respects, because if you try and go over what you can do, then you really just screw yourself.
I totally agree with you there. You do have to ride your own race, but nevertheless, I got the impression that Carapaz's kind of second wind coincided with Roglic just beginning to show some signs of struggling, and I wondered if he was just able to somehow reach into himself and get something out. Because of that, he would have got a real boost from seeing that. You know, we've spoken a lot about Jumbo-Visma and how strong they are, and they were again today. A fantastic turn from Jonas Vingegaard. Now, you got the proper pronunciation of that, Lizzie. I don't know how Lionel did earlier.
I actually messaged my Danish teammate, Emma Norsgaard, during the stage to ask her to send me a voice note of the pronunciation, which I think is Jonas Vingegaard. So,
Vingegaard.
Yeah, sensational ride from him. He was just absolutely tearing it up on the front. And again, another huge young talent coming through. And of course, I mean, the whole team again looked sensationally strong. You know, they've barely faltered all week apart from the raincoat gate. The team is so strong. But I agree with you that that mental aspect of performance at the end, you see your rival struggling a bit. Carapaz really, you know, he really cashed in on that. And then Roglic probably suffered a little bit from that. And he never, ever gave up, Roglic. He absolutely fought to the end. And you could actually hear on the TV him screaming when it crested over the top of the climb and it was the final downhill few hundred metres to the line. And he was saying, go, 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 to Sepkus. So he was still fighting to the line to get every single second.
Was he saying, oh, open your mouth, man, start breathing. It's time to try. Vingegaard, he won a stage at the Tour Poland last year, I think it was. And I think he won a stage of, you know, there were several young, very young riders away together. And it was just like a sort of vision of the future. And he's only 23. He's ridden really well at this Vuelta. He's another guy they have who's clearly incredibly talented and able to do a brilliant job for the team. If you watch the guys who were going out the back while he was at the front, it was quite instructive, I thought. A word for Chris Froome today, though. I think he was, you know, kind of going backwards by that point, but a decent, a much more encouraging performance from him today and on a tough stage. And I thought, you know, I could see him. He was really wanting to be there for Carapaz, I felt. And I thought he did a good job.
It was almost like he had no choice, to be honest. Because,
well, exactly.
You know, Amador was looking in a rocky patch anyway before he then crashed. So on the penultimate climb, he was off the back, and then he was chasing back on the really sketchy descent, which was coming in and out through the trees, you know, just icy patches of road. We didn't see what happened, but, you know, he crashed into a wall, and then I understand that his saddle was broken, so he had to have a bike change. But after that, he didn't seem to fight to get back to help. Perhaps he knew that there was nothing he could do because it was straight into the Angleroo. So really, Froome had no other choice but to be there. Considering where he's come from and where he's been in the rest of this Vuelta, the performance that he gave on the penultimate climb, kind of doing a dual two-up attack with Carapaz and then riding a hard tempo on the front to kind of shed the riders out the back, I would say that was an exceptional performance considering where he's been for the rest of this Vuelta, and is a really good sign of his progress, you know, and his recovery and his potential future form.
Just something on Chris Froome, because a couple of days ago he tweeted about heading back into the mountains and being inspired by Jens Voigt's catchphrase, shut up legs. And somebody replied to him to say, you know, obviously Chris Froome, a multiple Grand Tour winner. The reply was, please do not degrade in servant work. Focus on the new season. Next year you can win again. And Froome replied to that saying, I wouldn't ask any teammate to do for me what I wouldn't do for them. And I think that that was, today was the first real opportunity for him to do that work in a much more visible way. I think we've seen hints of that teammate work that he's done earlier on in stages when he's been able to. And as we are now a couple of weeks into the race, you know, he's coming round. And if we want to see him back, or if people want to see him back at his best, contending when he rides for Israel Startup Nation next year, it's important that he has a good, solid three-week race under his belt here at the Vuelta. And there's not an awful lot of big climbing to go in the final week, just really the penultimate stage next Saturday. He's ridden himself into some sort of form, not the Chris Froome of old, of course, but from, like you say, Lizzie, from where he's come from, probably the most that we could have expected from him.
I agree, and I'd also like to add that, you know, to what that person tweeted, is that any work that you do for your teammates, everything is so valuable and nothing is in servant. And just because you're working in the first 10, 20, 30K of a bike race, just because you're the person getting bottles, doesn't mean that that's not valuable work. Somebody's got to do it. Actually, getting bottles on a hot day for your leader is just about the most valuable job out there. Keeping your team leader hydrated, getting them ice bags, you know, that is a really, really hard job. You know, you try putting 6 kgs in a musette and then riding up a climb and finding your leader at the back of the bunch, working your way through 150 people to get there. It's flipping hard. And yeah, it's a really valuable job. And of course, he wasn't able to do the hard work, the late work earlier in this Vuelta, and he's riding into it really well. And I'm really happy to be able to see him to do the work on the climbs now. But for sure, all the work he's done in this Vuelta has been valuable, no matter at what point in what stage it was.
I'll have you know, Lizzie, I carry the equivalent of 6 or 7 bidons naturally. But just to go back to Hugh Carthy briefly, because, you know, it was an impressive win, and it's something he's been preparing for half his life, really, because when he was a child, his summer holidays were with his family going off to ride famous climbs in France, Mont Ventoux and big climbs in the Alps, with his dad driving the car and getting the bikes out and riding the climbs. And there's something, you know, you mentioned Dan Martin's style. Somebody mentioned Dan Martin's style a couple of days ago, how he never truly looks comfortable. Hugh Carthy is a little bit similar, and I do think there's a sort of throwback, certainly to the era I got interested in cycling in the 80s, when gears were bigger, bikes were heavier, and you know, the climbers were much more physical specimens, and there was something attractive and kind of almost romantic about that struggle, the bike against the mountain, which Hugh Carthy and Dan Martin, you know, they wouldn't necessarily win Sepp Kuss awards for climbing mountains with their mouth closed, looking absolutely immaculate, kind of, you know, preppy style. But
we should say, I mean, Sepp Kuss is trying as hard as those guys.
Well, of course
guys.
He is.
It's funny, isn't it, though? No, but you watch him and think it must be easy. And David Godu yesterday as well, similarly stylish and easy looking. The effort must be the same.
It's funny. I agree with you. So often when I'm in a breakaway and people will be reporting it on Twitter, and then they'll say, oh, she's got, you know, a laboured look about her. You know, she's really turning the pedals like this. And Gabriel, my husband, will reply just saying, well, that's just what she looks like on a bike. Trust me, she's fine. So, yeah, I look a bit like Froome, and I look like I'm working hard.
And they used to say the same of Froome. But that, I remember people saying that made Froome a really tough opponent, because you didn't know really how. You couldn't. There were no signals that you could really read, because he always looked in trouble. He always looked laboured and as if he was really fighting it. And that made him, conversely, quite a tough opponent, because you couldn't really read any signs.
Yeah, it definitely works both ways. And for sure, you know, when Sepp Kuss is the GC leader in a race, which I'm sure before long he will be, that's also going to be tough, because he's going to be riding and you're going to be like, why is he not hurting? Why is he fine?
Why is he not trying?
Why is his mouth so closed?
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
So we've got a question from John Chase. We didn't get around to this question before Ride London, but it's still probably very relevant for people who are going to spend a lot of time on the indoor trainers, maybe on Zwift. John writes that he has a fueling question for James. I was due to participate in Ride London this year, which has now sadly been cancelled. Instead, I think I'll ride the equivalent course on Zwift on what would have been the day. Hope it went well, John. What would be the best strategy to fuel for this experience? Yes, I've got some SIS turbo powder on its way to me in anticipation. Yeah, so I guess it's a question, James, about
you know, fueling for a lengthy ride, in this case 100 miles on the indoor trainer?
Yeah, I think go right back to basics. And just because the same distance is cycled indoor versus outdoor, the fueling demands are pretty similar. So it comes back to those principles of fueling well before, during and after. And during the ride itself, depending on the intensity and so on and how hard you actually want to go, the golden rules is between 60 to 90 grams of carbohydrates per hour. Now, normally on an outdoor ride, that's a mixture of solids, gels and fluids. And I think the same principles relate to your indoor ride. You mix and match those sources depending to your own individual preference. But it probably is worth saying that based on the whole turbo conversation that we had a couple of months ago now, a lot of indoor riders report feeling a lot hotter and sweating more. So pay more attention to your fluid requirements. But you could also use some of the menthol products that we've just launched to try and pay some attention to your cooling demands and your thermoregulation. So really, as a take-home message, it would be don't treat them completely differently because the energetic demands are the same, but pay specific attention to your fluid intake and how cool you can be throughout the ride.
Well, that was James Morton, Director of Performance Solutions at Science and Sport, also the Professor of Exercise, Metabolism and Nutrition at Liverpool John Moores University. And he was answering a listener's question. If you have a question for James, please email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. And if you record it as an audio file, all the better. Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast as they've done since 2016. If you want 25% off all your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code at the checkout, SISCP25. Now, a little bit earlier this evening, I caught up with our man in Spain, Daniel Freib. Where are you, Daniel?
Well, Rich, still in Asturias, but leaving. I heard the stage winner, Hugh Carthy, saying in an interview tonight that he had 7 hours in the bus after the stage. I think that was a big old fib.
Huh.
He can't possibly have had 7 hours. He'd be in, I don't know where he'd be if he drove for 7 hours west. But
Benidorm?
No, about 4 hours. 4 hours to A Coruña, which is sort of the race base for the rest day.
And were you up at the summit of the Angleru, Daniel, and you know, one of very few people up there? What was it like today?
Well, Rich, it felt like an immense privilege to be up there today to see the Angleru as anyone would encounter it on any of the 365 days in a normal year. Very quiet, as you can imagine, almost solemn, the silence up there today. And yeah, really an opportunity to appreciate something that's not often spoken about when people do discuss the Angleru, and that's its natural beauty. And also just to see it at a very different time of year to when we usually experience it in September or end of August to September. So see it in November, you know, beautiful sort of autumn colours are starting to encroach over landscape. As I said, a very rewarding and a sort of privileged experience it felt like.
And what did it feel like, or what was your reaction when over the kind of summit, because there's that little kind of flattish bit to the finish, when you saw a large sort of gangly figure in pink appear?
The last time I was up the Angleru was also, well, what felt like a very significant moment at the time. It was when Alberto Contador won his last mountain stage as a pro rider. Chris Froome won the Vuelta the same day. He sort of sealed Vuelta victory 2017. Contador, incidentally, of whom Guillaume Martin is doing a decent impression in this world. So I remember in that 2017 Vuelta, Contador attacked on something like 14 and 21 stages. I think out of the, how many stages have we had? Is it 11 after today or 12? Guillaume Martin has attacked in over half.
I saw your tweet suggesting that he would probably be in the break tomorrow as well.
Yeah, no doubt. Carthy, I mean, it was a bit of a surprise when he went away. Not necessarily the kind of climber or the kind of physique that you would associate with the Angleru and the gradients on the Angleru. I mean, you know, he does weigh under 70 kilos, but he's a big guy. That not a style you would associate with someone who would thrive on the Angleru either. Quite a sort of a violent, muscular, very robust sort of way of climbing. Quite an interesting contrast with previous winners on the Angleru, guys like Contador, Heras, Chava Jimenez, these sort of classic one.
I guess Wout Poels, who's finished first and second, is quite tall and rangy as well, isn't he?
Yes, Rich, exactly. And Paul actually did a decent ride today, didn't he? Sneaking into the top 10 a la Pernsteiner.
Well, yeah, I used a golfing analogy tonight in the podcast. I said that Roglic is leader in the clubhouse. Would you agree with that? I'm sure you would.
Yes, yeah, not a bad analogy. I noticed that you you took exception, quite rightly, to one of Donald Trump's tweets earlier today. But I thought that what most offended you about that probably wasn't the content of the tweet. It was all the sentiment. It was more the fact that he mentioned golf, I imagine, but...
There was quite a lot. I mean, it would take quite a long time to unpack that, as they say. So I'll leave people to go and look at that themselves. But it connected golf, Sean Connery, Scotland, and other things. I've noticed, Daniel, you've been speaking a lot. Been a lot of your interviews posted online with Chris Froome, and I thought Froome had a decent day today. But more than that, he seems to have been very sort of generous with his time and certainly willing to stop and talk quite a lot. How have you found him?
It was interesting yesterday how he took on this role of spokesman of the peloton. I suppose looking around at the field here at the Vuelta, it's kind of a natural role for him because there aren't that many experienced riders around. And that was something actually also occurred to us at the Giro when the sort of protest or the refusal to start stage 2 days from the or 3 days from the end in Morbegno. It struck us then that the sort of statesmen of the peloton this year noticeably, well, I don't know how many have gone into retirement over the last couple of years, but they suddenly seem to be heavily outnumbered by these young riders that we've been speaking so much about. And also their influence seems to be shrinking as well. I mean, you've seen that at this Vuelta with Valverde as well. There's a real sense of generational change. But Froome is one of those whose voice carries weight. But also in interviews, I mean, you asked me how he's been in this Vuelta. I think he's sort of moving into a more reflective phase of his career. You've experienced this as well. You've spoken to him about Vueltas and Tours and Giro Giri of yore over the past few months, and he's a lot more open, and he feels able to, for example, talk about, you know, what was quite a controversial Vuelta in 2011, whether he was allowed to ride for himself essentially, or whether he was waiting for Bradley Wiggins, that kind of thing. Subjects which for a long time, for years, you know, after they happened, were still quite thorny subjects. I get the impression he feels quite sort of liberated now. I mean, you know, he's created his career, he's constructed his palmarès. I think he's still got not a point to prove to himself, but maybe a point he wants to prove to other people about how he can get back to something like the level he was at before. But that is the final challenge of Chris Froome's career, I think. He seems like a man at peace with certainly a lot of what he's accomplished over the last 10 or 15 years.
Well, Daniel, we'll leave you to your drive. You got far to go now?
No, just arriving, Rich. We're in a place called Navia tonight.
And a busy rest day tomorrow for you?
No, not really, Rich. A few Zoom calls, if I can get Zoom to work, always a bit of an issue. No, rest up, ready for this very unusual time trial that we've got coming on Tuesday. Well, very unusual, at least in the last 1.8 kilometres up that very steep Mirador de Etzaro climb. Were you up there when we went up there in, what was it, 2016? A real shark's tooth of a climb. Very short, very steep. One of the typical, notorious, concrete-paved Vuelta climbs.
I don't think I was, but I could be wrong. I can't remember. There's so many of these climbs and new ones every year, the Vuelta. I made this point in the podcast last night that this is one of the great things about the Vuelta. It's not just about a couple of big mountain ranges, is it? There are these kind of hidden climbs dotted all over the country. Well, Daniel, we'll check in with you again in a couple of days. Hopefully a few more twists and turns in the Vuelta, but have a good rest day.
Thank you, Rich. Likewise.
Well, that was Daniel. Thanks for that, Daniel. And we'll hear from Daniel again in the final week of the Vuelta. There is other stuff going on. The Tour de France route for next year is being announced tonight, a virtual event rather than a physical live event that we would sometimes have been at. We're going to miss it for tonight's episode, but we will be joined on Tuesday by Francois Thomazeau, and I suspect we'll go into the Tour route for next year in some detail. And there is some other racing going on. Lizzie, you've got vested interest in at least one of the national titles awarded this weekend.
Indeed I do. So yesterday, the national championships of Italy took place for the elite women, and Elisa Longo Borghini backed up her TT title that she got earlier in the year by winning the road race as well. Over in Switzerland, Stefan Kung won the men's race with a gap of 4:57 to the next rider. And in the women's race, it was won by my teammate Elise Chabé. So that was really great to see her get the win after a really challenging month for the team. And actually, the defending champion, who's also my teammate, Marlon Reuser, she was actually unable to race after a member of her family tested positive for COVID only 2 days ago. So yeah, it was nice to see someone in our team get some success at this late stage and after a difficult month.
Absolutely. And there's one more race that you missed out there. The Cycling Podcast Swift Cappuccino ride this morning.
Well, it wasn't competitive, was it?
Box Hill felt pretty competitive to me. I went pretty hard up Box Hill in an appropriate gear, unlike Hugh Carthy.
Did you win? Were you quickest on Box Hill?
No, of course I wasn't.
Oh, I was suddenly worried there.
I'm just racing against myself. I don't know how I compared with others, but I set a new personal best for the second half of Box Hill, which I was pretty
pleased about.
Do you know
what? I think our listener, Sean Dwyer, was quickest on Box Hill today.
Well done, Sean. It was good fun, though. Nice to see a lot of people out.
Was, yeah. Big group today, wasn't there? I mean, I don't think the elastic banding quite work because we all split. I was in the gruppetto. I don't know how you managed to get further up the road than me, but I mean, obviously your pixels are lighter than mine.
No shame with that.
My pixels are at the appropriate weight, Lionel. How dare you suggest?
I'm suggesting
otherwise.
Nothing.
Anyway,
I'm getting some scales shipped to France for you.
Back to the Vuelta. I said that Roglic is the leader in the clubhouse. We've got the time trial on Tuesday, of course. Hugh Carthy, he's no slouch in a time trial. He can put in a decent time trial. I'm looking at the Giro last year where he was the San Marino time trial. He was eighth that day, 1:30 down on Roglic. He might be okay in that, but Roglic, we expect him to take quite a lot of time out of his GC rivals, don't we?
I think it's sometimes hard to know, because when a rider suddenly steps up to being a GC leader and you look back at their time trial performances, okay, sometimes it's easy to know when they were trying or not, but often they're not actually going to be trying, because if you're helping somebody else in a race, then the ideal situation is that you go as slow as you possibly can without getting time cut. Sometimes you get the opportunity to go full gas in a time trial because maybe your team wants you to have the opportunity, or maybe, like Filippo Ganna, you have a chance to win the race, even though you have another GC guy to look after. But a lot of the time, if you don't think you're going to win and you've got a GC guy to look after and you've got a job to do tomorrow, then you just try and sandbag the time trial. So yeah, it's pretty hard to tell sometimes. And I think Hugh Carthy's actually going to surprise us. I don't think he's going to win the time trial. He's not going to do a Pogacar, I don't think. He's obviously stepped up this year, and I think he's probably going to put in a surprisingly good result. And at least I hope so. And I do think Roglic is still the favourite, and still the favourite to go back into red. And that probably favours Ineos as well, because really they don't want the responsibility of red, and they'll then look to take it back on the penultimate stage. So, yeah, we'll see.
It's a really interesting time trial on Tuesday, though. And they're not words I often say. La Planche...
not in 2020, at least.
Well, La Planche de Belfi was obviously spectacular, wasn't it? I mean, this is a long, flat test. It's sort of 30... Well, the whole distance is 33.7 kilometres. Almost all of it is rolling, flat. And then there's this third category climb at the end where it's steep in places. There's a couple of kilometres where it's pushing 14%. So it's going to be a test, as all time trials are, a test of judgment. And I wouldn't rule Carapaz out either. I mean, we look back to last year's Giro, and that San Marino time trial, I remember that really well, because that was the day when we thought, well, Roglic has got this in the bag here. And of course, it didn't work out that way. Carapaz was not even on a name on our lips at that point. I mean, he had a decent time trial, but nothing that would have merited mention even on the day. And yet he ended up winning the race. But he's kind of, I think Carthy Carapaz, they may well be reasonably well matched, and it's a lot will depend on Roglic's performance. But you've got to also bear in mind, you know, if the strategy is to keep the red jersey, you know, within touching distance and then do the job in the time trial, well, this is the day that really, really counts for Roglic, because it's all on Tuesday stage, isn't it? Because as you say, Lizzie, the penultimate stage is another uphill finish. If it comes down to Carapaz needs to attack and put time into Roglic, you know, Roglic doesn't want to be in a position where he's in any way vulnerable. And we may well be looking back then thinking he needed to get the job done in the time trial, but we shall see what happens on Tuesday.
Oh, maybe they should have listened to my podcast on Friday and attacked yesterday. Maybe I'll be getting a job at Jumbo-Visma as a sports director if this doesn't work out for them. But I mean, also the other thing that's really interesting about when you look back at Roglic's time trial results is obviously he's a fantastic time trialist. That goes, you know, you don't even need to say that. But actually, there have also been some instances when he's had some not so great results at the end of long tours. And we're not just looking at one tour here that he's been doing. We're looking at the whole bigger picture of him having done the Tour de France and come second there and come over to this and having done, you know, races in between and all the way having gone back to Slovenian national championships, which were really relatively early. You know, a lot of people didn't start their season until much later than that, and he was already flying at that point. So when you look at it in the history of some of his performances in time trials in the later stages of some grand tours or some larger, longer tours, and the accumulated fatigue that he's got, I wouldn't say it's an out and out given what the result's going to be. He definitely is the favorite, but I still think anything can happen.
George Bennett, remember, said that he thought GC would be all but sort of done and dusted by Tuesday evening. You know, if there's a parallel with that Giro last year where Richard Carapaz was a surprise winner, it was Roglic and Nibali. They kind of handed it to Carapaz by being obsessed with each other and really marking each other to the exclusion of everybody else, and Carapaz sneaked up the road. Now, I don't know that there's somebody who could do that, but I'm still quite impressed by Movistar. Marc Soler's fallen out of GC today. But so Enric Mas is really their strongest card to play now. And he was third on the stage. He's still fifth on GC, only a minute and 50 down. But he did look strong today. And as you said a couple of nights ago, Lionel, a couple of years ago at the Vuelta where he kind of broke through, wasn't it, when Simon Yates won? He got stronger as the race went on. I don't think this last week is tough enough to really allow riders like that to put Roglic on the rack. We can but hope, and that penultimate day might offer up something if people are still close. And I think Roglic has got to tire at some point, hasn't he? I mean, his record this year is remarkable. He must be beginning to run out of steam, you would have thought. And he did look absolutely spent at the finish. Somebody else who looked spent at the finish was the man who finished last today, wasn't he, Lionel?
Indeed, Harry Tanfield, riding his first Grand Tour for AG2R. He's been sending us some updates over the last couple of days. Had a pretty tough weekend. He was in the last group yesterday and was last over the line today, but made the time cut by a few minutes. Let's hear, first of all, talking about yesterday's stage to Falapona, and then talking about the Angliru stage today.
Just finished stage 11, the Queen stage. Managed to make it within the time cut after getting dropped after 3Ks with a few other guys. We had a 7-man TTT basically to the line, although two got dropped and got in the car. There was five of us that packed it round to the end, and we made it within 5 or 6 minutes of the time limit. I've got a bit of an injury with a muscle on my right leg, so it was pretty difficult in the last part, but we made the time cut. Just sending this from the bus. We've literally just finished the stage 12, finishing up the Angliru. Was a bit more controlled today than yesterday. Quite a big group, peloton, for at least 60Ks. And then with two climbs to go, the category ones before the Angliru, it kicked off a bit, and found myself a nice group with 30, 35 guys until the bottom of the Angliru. And then that was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, pretty much. It wouldn't have been so bad if my muscle wasn't ruined inside of my leg. But
yeah, thank God I had a 34% on the back, because otherwise I wouldn't have got up, basically. With a 36-34. We've got rest day tomorrow, so don't have to ride. And then we've got the TT. So hopefully my muscle can get through an hour of that.
Well, that was Harry Tanfield. Good to hear from him. We should say we've lost one of our audio diarists. Nick Dlamini was a non-finisher yesterday, unfortunately. And we're still trying to find out exactly what happened to him. But that's a shame that he is a non-finisher at the Vuelta, especially with his team NTT looking kind of doomed. A lot of NTT riders have been signing for other teams, and there has been no update on their search for a sponsor. A little shout out again for the latest episode of Service Course, which I listened to. I listened to most of it today on my Zwift ride. That's presented by you, Lizzie, and Tom Wally. Really interesting, all about 3D printing. And there's an interview with Dimitris Katsanis, a very familiar name, but I don't think I'd heard him speaking before. And really, really great interview, and a very kind of jovial, light-hearted sounding fella. I enjoyed that a lot, and it's a fascinating subject. I mean, Service Course is a bit like Freakonomics, I think. Freakonomics for cycling. It's expanding my brain slightly.
That's not that hard, is it?
Oh, brutal. Brutal.
Oh, that is brutal.
I'm not going to get invited back.
The thing
am I?
Is, there is room for expansion in Richard's brain because he's got such a large head.
I don't think I've got a large head.
Not to mention the other factor that there's room for expansion.
Goodness me. Not even 30 yet, Lizzie, and you're dishing out abuse. But you do have that milestone coming up soon, don't you?
Oh, thanks for reminding us, Richard.
Well, don't worry, we'll wish you a happy birthday when it comes. Is that your stint finished with us?
Tuesday. I'm afraid you're going to have to bear with me for one more stage.
Just Tuesday. Oh, that's right. It's the 4 days of Lizzie Banks, isn't it? How could I have forgotten? So is it Francois on Wednesday, Lionel?
Francois on Wednesday. I mean, we'll obviously talk a bit about the tour on Tuesday's episode, but then we'll get the inside track from Francois,
who is very close to
ASO on Wednesday, no doubt. Just before that, though, tomorrow, Richard, Kilometre Zero.
Oh, yes.
The final episode of Kilometre Zero is looking back at the Giro won by Theo Gegenhardt with, a fantastic interview with Theo Gegenhardt about the Giro is coming very soon to friends of the podcast, but snippets of it will be heard in the Kilometre Zero tomorrow, along with the thoughts of Jai Hindley and Luke Roberts, the Sunweb sports director. Kilometre Zero out tomorrow on the rest day, and we'll return with our recap of the time trial stage on Tuesday.
Thank you, everybody who signed up as a friend of the podcast, and as Lionel mentioned there, there's an interview with Theo Gegenhardt coming, other special episodes coming as well. But for me, a big thank you to Oliver Coke, Mark Draper, Seaborn, Gary Kelly, Jason Haygarth, Hamish Mitchell, and Greg Watson.
And thank you to Neil McCready, Timothy J. Corner, NJ Tiffany, Paul Allen, Gareth Pinchin, John Dempsey, and Barry Mooney.
And for me, a huge thank you to David Cattrall, Gordon Fisher, Richard Dodds, Peter Slyker, Nolan Heather, or perhaps Heather Nolan, Hamish Wintle, and Rosemary Hamilton.